Blog Talk Radio.
Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, August 31st. Today, we're going to be chatting with our good friend Frank Burke up in Wisconsin. Of course, Frank, an author, a businessman, as well as a contributor to American Thinker and a great friend of our show. And we're going to talk about something that always fascinates me, and that is you have these horrific natural disaster, whether it's a hurricane here in Houston. You obviously had the situation in Katrina or New Orleans. Back in 2005, I remember in 1985, there was a massive earthquake in Mexico City. And, you know, after you get through the shock and the cleaning up and putting people sort of back together as well as you can, there comes a great debate. What do you do now? How do you rebuild? And I've always felt that this debate should happen by trying to make the city less vulnerable, if you will, to, in the case of Houston, the flooding, for example. In the case of New Orleans, it was the levees. And in the case of Mexico City back in 1985, was the fact that some buildings had not been built correctly for earthquake. They've improved that a lot since. And they've had some earthquakes since 1985, and yet there has not been much damage at all because the architecture was the right one. So these are the kinds of things we're going to be chatting with our friend Frank. In fact, let me put him on. Let me say hello to Frank all the way up in Wisconsin, where I bet it's really nice, Frank.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's in the 60s. It's like an early fall day, bright sunshine. It's just lovely, Silvio.
Well, they're changing your climates on you there, Frank.
Right.
They're giving you fall in August and
yeah, which is fine with me. It's been a beautiful, cool August. Normally, you know, August can be a heat wave, but this time it's been very nice.
Yeah, I mean, I see that when I look at that. I always look at the map, you know, at the weather map to see Wisconsin, and it's always we're in the high 80s today, which for us would be like a winter storm passing through here at the end of August. but I mean, that's kind of, you get used to it. The one thing about the climate, I don't care where it is. I think my mother once said that if we lived in the sun, we get used to the heat eventually.
Right. Well, I think that's true to an extent, but to be honest with you, I don't know that I could ever do it. I think that's why some people prefer to live in other places.
That's right. As someone said, that's why we have 50 states, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know,
go ahead.
I was going to say, when I was a kid, I had asthma, which I still have. And when it got very humid, the breathing just got so terrible. But in the cold weather, the nice, bracing, cool weather, it just felt great. And it's still that way, so.
Well, I remember hearing family stories from Cuba that when people in Cuba would suffer from asthma, they would send those people for special treatment to Arizona. And I never really understood why Arizona, but they say because it's so dry. And they felt that would, I mean, that's what they used to say, so. You had, you know, one of those Cubans was my father's uncle, who actually spent a couple of months in Arizona or New Mexico, one of those two places. And again, it was because of the very dry heat, not the humidity that they had in Cuba, Frank.
Right. No, I have heard that. But to be honest with you, I'm not one of those people who can take the heat either. So it may be dry, but it's still heat.
Right. Well, that's what they say in Texas. You know, when people say, "Well, it's so humid in Houston," don't complain. And I said, "But it's so hot in Dallas."
Right. You know, exactly.
One way or the other, it's summer. One way or the other. Well, today we're going to be chatting. I like to just kind of kick around some ideas with you about what happens to Houston after, you know, what maybe Houston could look like 5 years from now.
Sure.
And I was using the example of a couple of examples I'm familiar with: Mexico City in 1985, and then of course everybody remembers Katrina. And despite all the problems of Katrina in 2005. Much of it was unfairly, and I want to underline unfairly, put on President Bush. I think it should have been put on the
mm-hmm.
governor and the
You're
mayor of New
right.
Orleans, who did a devastating job. But anyway, that's history. But I do remember in Mexico City, they had an earthquake, and in 1985, it was pretty bad, Frank. But then
mm-hmm.
they found out that part of the problem was that some of the buildings had not been properly, prepared for earthquake. They went back and they fixed it, and you know, now they have earthquakes and just a few broken windows, nothing like 1985. And I was thinking the same thing about Houston, considering that the biggest single problem that I see in Houston is the flooding. I mean, if the flooding had only been half as much as it is, the damage would have been so much less. But before we get to your ideas and kicking this around, what is your reaction to the way Texas is handling this? How does it look, let's say, from Wisconsin, the way Texas is doing all of this?
I think that Texas is doing a heck of a job. I think they're doing a perfect job. When you compare it to what was going on in New Orleans years ago, all I can say, and you know, granted, they were both terrible experiences, but I think many of the people in New Orleans, especially in what was it, the Ninth Ward, were so used to the government doing so much for them that it was, well, where's the government? When are they going to come down? When are they going to take care of me? And the people in Texas are saying, hey, get out our boats, get out our pickups, let's get these people out. And they're doing just a great job. They're real Americans. They're real people. And they know if you want it to happen, you make it happen. So my hat is off to them, and thank God for them.
Yeah. I was thinking, as you were saying, that there is a furniture retailer here in Houston, who has been there for a long time, has made a lot of money, has been a very successful businessman in Houston, and he basically opened up his entire floor and said, come in, and if you don't have a house, or if you've been, if you don't have a place, you come in, you stay at my place. And he also, meaning the furniture shop, which is a huge floor. I mean, he's got hundreds of feet of that, and he also opened up his floor to a National Guard unit who was working very hard, you know, and who was who really could use a comfortable bed. And I said to myself, this man is doing all of this out of his own pocket, because this furniture is obviously not going to be the same after all these people sleep on it or use it. And
right.
He said, and he was on television saying, you know what, I got to take care of the people. I mean,
mm-hmm.
to be fair, this guy is extremely wealthy. He probably, you know, he's not going to really lose any money per se. I mean, he'll lose money this year, but he'll make it up. But it seems to me the character of a man to say something like that, when he could have just as easily locked up the place, gone to his home or left town and said, I'm not messing with this, let somebody else. So I think that confirms what you're saying. And then you've seen all these videos of volunteers, and you know, my brother lives in South Houston. His home, his neighborhood was flooded, although his home fortunately didn't have water come in. It got pretty close, but it didn't come in. And he did confirm to me that there were, in fact, people who would go to your door and say, how are you doing? Do you need any help? Do you need any water? Can we help you?
Yeah.
And so people are, in fact, I mean, I think, I really believe Texas has looked awfully good here. And,
I think so, too. And let me give you another example. The way they take care of their pets. I mean, you know, I know the government after Katrina said, okay, if people are going to be rescued, we can legitimately rescue their pets. But boy, when you see all those pictures of people, they have nothing else, but they've got the dog or the cat or whatever it is that they've got. I mean, that is great spirit. That's the hand of God. That's just a wonderful thing to see.
Right, and also horses and cows. If you see, I thought it was very interesting. You had these National Guardsmen who must have, you know, I suppose as difficult as their job is, they must have really enjoyed this particular one because they were literally bringing these horses in and even riding some horses out of the water. But
yes.
I think it tells you something. You know, I wrote a post over at the American Thinker today, Frank, a little bit about this. And I said that Houston has proven all the race hustlers wrong. You have people like Jesse Jackson, like Al Sharpton.
Mm-hmm.
All they do, they're just race hustlers. I mean, they're just despicable people. At one time, maybe Jesse Jackson was a good man. I don't think he is anymore.
No.
He's nothing but a race hustler. And Al Sharpton, I've never had a high opinion of him at any time. To me, they're just race hustlers. And what Houston has done is that it has proven all these people wrong. Because when you see these rescuers, when you see this stuff going on down there, they're basically helping human beings. You don't see people saying, well, gee, I'm going to only take care of white people, or I'm only going to take care of, you know, my... No, no, it's across
exactly.
the board. You see somebody in need, you help them. And I think that tells you that there's a great quality about the United States that often gets overlooked by, you know, a media that I think honestly loves to, you know, bang the drums of racism, when in fact... That's not the true America, Frank.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't. The true America is what's happening down there. We're all one. People get into trouble, you help them out. You don't ask questions first. They need it, you give it to them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And even people who are in the country illegally were told, hey, look, you know, we're going to overlook now. You know,
mm-hmm.
we're not going to... You know, we're going to overlook that because you're a human being first. So I'm with you. I'm glad that Texas looks that way from the outside, because I think in here, I'm very proud of the work of so many volunteers. And you got to really hand it to the National Guard. And I tell you, you got to hand it to the governor, who has kept this thing together well. You got to hand it to President Trump, who came down here, although. In typical silly fashion from the media, it seemed like the First Lady's shoes became a bigger problem, Frank.
Yes, and they kept saying, well, he wasn't compassionate. Well, of course he was compassionate. What did they want him to do? Burst into a crying jag?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I've known a lot of very good men over the years. Well, one of them was my father.
Mm-hmm.
My father was obviously had a lot of empathy and sympathy for people, but my father was not the kind of guy who was going to grab somebody and start crying with him.
Right, right.
Now, my mother, yes, but not my father. And I think that this idea that you have to start crying and getting, you know, wimpy and, gee, let me cry with you. I mean, honestly, I think a lot of that is more theatrical than anything else, Frank.
I agree. I definitely agree.
Yeah. Reminds me of that funny scene one time when Bill Clinton was walking down, and as soon as he saw the camera, he started crying, pretending that he was crying because he
yes.
was apparently coming out of a funeral, okay? And he's walking down joking, and as soon as the camera is on him, he starts crying.
Yeah. Isn't that sick?
Isn't that amazing? But what did you think of the controversy about the First Lady's shoes? I mean, she walks out of the White House, and she's wearing high heels, and all these people are saying, well, you cannot wear high heels to go to a hurricane. Well, did they forget that it's a three-hour flight and that
right.
she could change? And I mean, Frank, sometimes these people, I wonder if they hear what they're saying, Frank. I wonder if they, they listen to themselves, Frank.
Well, you know, the thing is this, and this is so true, Sylvia. Mike Huckabee was on one of these stations, and they asked him about it, the criticism of Trump and Melania. And he had a great answer. He said, if Donald Trump had brought a drinking straw and sucked all the water out of Houston by himself, they still would have found something to complain about. So
they would have accused him of not sharing the water.
Right, exactly.
No, it is remarkable what the media has turned into, and when you see this thing, you know, with the First Lady's shoes, I mean that is truly silly. I don't know what else to say about it.
Yeah,
Frank,
ridiculous.
Let me take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to get into our topic today, which is some ideas about what to do with Houston. Lots of things going on in Houston. What do we do going forward in Houston?
This is Carlos Quevez, Heartbeat, and I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Nola Brasserie Authentic Cajun and Creole Restaurant, located at 1201 Main Street, downtown Dallas. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy jazz at 7:30 until midnight. So make your reservation today at 469-872-1820.
Well, I've had a chance to see this show, and I tell you, it is a great show. And I say so because it is a great show, not just because he's a dear friend and he lets me use his music on the radio show, Frank. But it is a great show. It is a great show.
I don't doubt it.
It is
I
a great
music
show.
And he is tremendous.
He really is. He really is. I'm going to try to get you a CD of his music so that you can hear it for yourself. You
that
may
would
recognize
be wonderful.
You may recognize some of the numbers when you hear them. Hey, that's from the show.
Right. But the theme from Silvio.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. You can, you know, it'll be there, featured on the Silvio program. You know,
right?
But he didn't say that on the CD. But I the next time he prints a second edition, I'm going to make sure that he does. But anyway, let's get into this, Frank, because I keep thinking to myself, obviously, you know, the terrible tragedy that happened, natural disaster. Now let's look ahead to the future. And I think there's always great opportunities about reconstructing this city. Obviously, the money's going to be there. Obviously, people want to rebuild their city. So all of the emotion, all of the ambition is there. But I kept thinking to myself, and I want to use a baseball stadium as an example. Now, a baseball stadium, obviously, a much smaller area, much less significant than a city. But baseball stadiums, particularly the ones built in the last 30 or 40 years, have incredible drainage systems. And it's not because they want the water to get out of the field. It's because the owners don't want to have to reschedule the game. And in essence, give you a free game, because when they reschedule, they ended up having a doubleheader, so they give you two for the price of one, as they say. And so they've gone. These new baseball stadiums are so good that if it rains at 5 o'clock, within a short time, the field will drain rather well, and the game can be played. I mean, it's hard to believe sometimes when you see the field after it's been raining for a couple of hours, how much water it can take and how well it drains. Now, again, it's not a perfect example because a baseball field is obviously a lot smaller than a city, but it would occur to me that if there was some way that we could limit the damage of floods by maybe creating extra drainage or even tunnels for the water to go, that would be in the best interest of the city, because they'd be able to retain a lot more of what they have. They wouldn't have to rebuild everything. There's a lot of stuff in Houston that is going to have to be rebuilt because that water takes a lot out of cities and the electrical infrastructure and all of that. So I guess that's my first question to you, Frank, and that is, how much do you think cities can prevent these floods? And maybe the better question is it cost effective? And then I promise to let you talk now, Frank.
No problem at all. Well, let me put it this way. There's no way to protect yourself against a flood like Houston has just had. This is a phenomenal event. It's, you know, the largest rainfall since it's been tracked in the history of this country. And I think that goes back to like 1871 when they started tracking the weather, somewhere around there. So there's no way you could deal with that. Now, any number of cities, Milwaukee is one of them, have created what they call deep tunnel projects, where they have a tunnel that can fill up with water where there is a reasonable flood, and then when the rain dies down, they can pump it out. So that is doable. It's very expensive, but it's doable. But I'll move on for a moment to another aspect of it, which I think is equally important. And that's the fact that when you have an event like this, and naturally so, emotion takes center stage. I want to rebuild. I want my house back. I want my neighborhood back. I want it to be back just like it was. And that's a natural human reaction. We all want to go home. But sometimes that's not the most logical thing. One of my favorite writers is a man named Witold Rybczynski, who was born in Poland, moved to England, lived in Canada, and is now a professor of architecture at the University of Pennsylvania. And he writes extensively on a lot of subjects, including architecture. But in one of his more recent books, he talked about the fact that it's been a political thing for many years to talk about saving America's cities, saving the downtowns. And what he said, which is extraordinary for an architect, is really not a good idea. People have built other cities, newer cities, out from the center city. We no longer need a center city as a hub of shopping. In some areas, maybe we do, but increasingly, you know, New York is the financial center. Fine. With the internet and the web, it could be anywhere. It could be in a cloud, and it probably will be in the future. So the bottom line is, when you're looking at a situation like this, and you have, if not a clean sheet of paper in front of you, at least the opportunity to rectify some of the things that maybe shouldn't have been done, areas that should not have been developed, this may be the opportunity to say, look, folks, I know you liked it here, but we're going to move you there. There's a little town in Illinois called Shawneetown. It was on the Ohio River, and in 1936, during one of the great floods, the town was wiped out. So they literally moved the buildings and the town about 10 miles inland. And it's now New Shawneetown. It's been there for ages, and that seems to be doing quite well. There are still a few buildings left, monuments and whatever, in the old part. But they realized that there's no way to really protect this area from another flood in the Ohio River. So it's best to move the town, and that might be the case. Now, before I stop talking, and I've got a cold, forgive me for my strange-sounding voice, one more thing, though, and that is the fact that if you look at the economy of Houston, much of it is based on the petrochemical industry and the energy industry, and we need that, and that will be with us. But it's important to realize that right now, as we speak, the major convenience store chains are looking at plans for what's going to happen when we don't sell as much gasoline. How are we going to convert to being restaurants or food stores or markets? Because with the electric cars, with you know, natural gas as a fuel, we know that gasoline is going to go down. So that is something that Houston needs to take into account. They won't do it immediately. They can't do it immediately. We need the gas now. But in a long-range plan, you want to say, hey, wait a minute, folks, petrochemicals is a lot more than gasoline, so where are we going to move that?
Right.
And that, those are a
point.
Couple of the things I think that should be on their mind.
No, those are great points, Frank. I was going to say one thing about Houston, too, in that the petrochemical, you're right, the refineries are very important to the country. Another very important part of Houston, and interestingly enough, it's going to become more important over the next 10 years, and that's the Port of Houston. Because
absolutely.
as the Panama Canal expands, and I think the expansion is happening right now, I think it's over in about 5 years. I mean, the canal is going to be, I think it's going to be able to handle three times more traffic.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to mean that more and more ships, let's say, coming from Asia, are going to be able to go directly across the canal right to Houston. So Houston is going to be with us, you know, for a while, as you indicated.
It is,
because,
and this is,
and the,
this is
the
a
port
great
is
opportunity.
There.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The
Let's
port is
draw
there.
The
and,
port.
Absolutely. And, I mean, the port is, I remember about 3 or 4 years ago, I was talking to a gentleman in Houston who was working with the port development. And the idea of the Port of Houston, Frank, is to be able to basically make it more cost-effective to avoid going into Seattle and L.A., where there are some heavy unions that
mm-hmm.
make it more expensive, and you're always having strikes and all that kind of stuff. And
absolutely.
Now you can go through the canal, and you can be in Houston, and then from Houston you take I-45, and then you take 35, and you're pretty much anywhere in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Or you take I-10, mm-hmm. you take I-10, and you go east-west in the country. So Houston
yeah.
has, in that sense, a very interesting position. So, yes, I don't think we want to change the economy too much. I would suggest this to the rebuilding of Houston, and I saw this when I was there a couple of times over the last few months. I've been there because my mom was staying with my brother in Houston, so we went to see her a couple of times. You know, it's interesting. When you enter Houston from Dallas, it's very dry. I mean, it's green,
mm-hmm.
but it's dry. And then as you're going south on 45 toward Galveston, then you begin to see a lot of water. And, you know, you begin to see a lot more water, a lot more swamps and all that kind of stuff. So I would think that maybe in the future they may want to do more housing development to the north, which then raises another question, Frank, that I want to put on the table. A lot of this building and development happens because it seems that the government becomes the insurance of last resort. If it was only private insurance, I bet a lot of those homes and a lot of those businesses would not exist because nobody would insure them. But it seems to me the federal government comes in and basically bails out the people who constructed in high flood areas, and then after the next flood, they'll do the same thing, Frank. So maybe that's another thing that can change, where the federal government can change how it distributes money the next time around, Frank, so that there are more incentives to get away from the water, Frank.
Well, you know, I agree with you completely, Silvio. In fact, to use a bad term, or a term that got a bad name years ago because of racial profiling, what it needs to do is to redline certain areas. And some of those areas are floodplains that are dangerously close to, live weather systems. Places like the Outer Banks of North Carolina, the Hollywood Hills that are susceptible to mudslides, Malibu Beach, and the idea is, look, if you want to build there, if you're rich enough, you want to build there, you can do that. But when the big bad weather system comes and takes your place out, the government is not going to help you out because you don't deserve it. You are dumb enough to build in the teeth of some place that has a demonstrable record of catastrophe.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. No, I think you're exactly right. And I've heard some conversation in some of the talk shows today, talking exactly about this point that, you know, we keep basically making it possible for people
mm-hmm.
to build in areas that are highly vulnerable. And I'm not necessarily saying that's Houston, because, I mean, a lot of Houston is looks like any other city. In fact, a lot of it looks like Dallas, actually. When you're
right.
going down some of the major expressways, you feel like you're in Dallas. But as you go further south, that's where you see a lot more water, and you begin to wonder, you know, can you really have all of those developments down there? And is that private? If that's private insurance, well, that's fine if they want to build it there. But if it's basically the government, then I have to ask myself a big question and say, is that really the role of government? My answer
right.
is no. My
no,
answer
I,
is
I
no.
agree with you. You know, I'll tell you one funny thing. Many years ago, I think the late 70s, early 80s, the first time I was going to visit Houston, I told a friend of mine, well, I've got a trip to Houston. And his response was, the city on the moon. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, wait till you come into Houston by airplane. You come in over nothing. It's just open land, and suddenly there's this big city there. And you know he was right.
Yeah. No, and it is true. I mean, it is really an amazing city, and there's this Highway 45 that sort of goes around downtown. I mean, and you can almost touch the skyscrapers from your car. That's
right.
That's how close you are. But it is the fourth largest city in the country, and a city that in many ways, you know, I always thought it was kind of funny, because whenever I would go to Mexico or talk to somebody from outside the United States, if you said you're from Dallas, they immediately associated Dallas with oil.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
of the Dallas television show.
Of course.
And they would say, oh, Dallas, the oil capital of America, all this oil there. And I'd say, well, let me disappoint you. Actually, it's not really that way. The real capital is Houston. That's really where the oil is.
Right.
That's really where the industry is. Dallas is more... I mean, there are some oil interests here, but certainly not anywhere near
mm-hmm.
what it is in Houston. So
I
always thought that was kind of funny.
I think you have the petroleum club there.
I think so, and I do think that the Ewings show up from time to time.
Right.
JR comes and drops in and checks on his buddies, but they do have the South Fork Ranch. It's open for business, so if you want to go and
okay.
take a little tour. You can do that, and in fact, the inside, you know, the furniture all looks the same as in the television show, and they've done a great job of doing that. They have tours in various languages, so it's a very popular thing with international figures. But I was going to say, Frank, as one last point here, I was going to say I actually feel pretty positive about the future of Houston. I think so too. They'll make some adjustments, but I think overall I'm positive about the future of Houston. I just think there's too many good people there. And as you say, petrochemicals and all that kind of stuff, which is very important for the future. So I would say I feel good about the future, but I would recommend a few changes, Frank.
Well, you're right, Sylvia. You're absolutely right. And, you know, I would say it this way, that Houston, as you pointed out, it's on a tipping point right now for the good, with the port coming in and the Panama Canal and all the changes that are being made. And I think that to sit down at this point and look at that and say, okay, we're obviously going to be a bigger city in some ways, so let's take a look at what happened in this disaster. Let's include in our plans for the infrastructure more escape routes if this ever happens again. How do we get people out? How do we evacuate them more quickly? What roads do we build? What do we take into account? What buildings could be shelters in the event that this happens again? And I think you'll end up with a much better city, because Houston has a lot going for it, not least of which, and probably the most important thing, is the spirit of its people, and God bless them.
Yes, and you know how important that is.
Absolutely.
It's like a human being. If you've got the right attitude and the right spirit, you can always meet adversity, Well, Frank, as always, thank you for your time. It's always a real treat to chat with you.
Well, likewise,
happy, Labor Day coming up. We've got a rock and roll show. We've got a rock and roll show that we've got planned up probably for, I'm guessing, the next couple of weeks. And we're going to keep a surprise what we're going to do. But I really want to just we can do more than one show, of course. But I hope that when we do a show in the future, that I hope we look at some of the top LPs in rock history. Because Rolling Stone, you may want to check this out if you, maybe you have already. But Rolling Stone magazine puts out the top 500 rock and roll LPs.
Wow.
Number one is Sgt. Pepper's. Number two is the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds. Number three is Revolver. Number four is Rubber Soul, the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles have three out of the top four, which you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often wondered if Sgt. Pepper's ought to be on the top of that list. It's a good album, but
uh-huh.
I've never thought of it as their best album. But I think
right.
Sgt. Pepper became more than music. It's almost like a symbol. So I would really at some time would love to chat with you about some of the selections in that list. And you can get this. If you cannot find it, I'll send you the link.
No, I do not know that one. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Rolling Stone magazine. I mean, I don't think the heck of a lot about Rolling Stone magazine. They're kind of politically left and,
right,
and at times
exactly.
very irresponsible, as you know. But as far as the music, you know, I usually just care about that. And they put together the top 500 LPs, the top 500 songs. I mean, they pretty much have a list for just about everybody, and the list is created by their experts or whatever, music experts. And I don't know, I would love to talk to you sometime about what you think of, let's say, the top 10 on that list.
I would love to talk with you about that.
Yeah,
and about some of the other aspects of it. And
yeah,
I have to say...
There on, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Silvio, that if our show was lucky enough to be budgeted at a very high level, so that we had research people and our own in-house music source... we might close up tonight with Dean Martin's recording of Going Back to Houston.
Yes, there you go. I almost thought about doing that, but I'm not sure if they're ready for music in Houston. Yes, but you're right. You're right. That would be a great song, Going Back to Houston by Dean Martin. Frank, thank you for your time. Happy Labor Day, and we've got a radio show coming up here pretty soon.
Likewise, and much love to you and the audience, and God bless.
Thank you so much. Our good friend, Frank Burke, up in Wisconsin. We're going to take a little break with a final thought, and we'll be right back.
The Canto Group is a recruiting firm located in Dallas, Texas that specializes in the placement of executives and engineering professionals with companies throughout Texas. If your company is seeking quality candidates in the fields of general managers, plant managers, sales, CFOs or controllers with a manufacturing background, production manager supervisors, engineering specializing in mechanical, manufacturing, industrial, electrical, safety, or quality engineers or designer drafters, feel free to contact our team regarding your company's future or current openings. Contact Silvio Canto Jr., email thecantogroup@aol.com, or visit our website, thecantogroup.com.
Well, let me say thank you to our friend Frank Burke up in Wisconsin for joining me today to talk about the future of Houston. As Frank was saying, and I agree with him 100%, Houston has a great future, has a great economy. Obviously, it's an important city and a very important, a lot of great industries there, petrochemicals, energy, the Port of Houston, a lot of great things. So I'm sure they will rebuild. But the biggest thing that Houston has going for it is a great spirit. The people have a great spirit. And when you have that, you're going to succeed, because people with a strong spirit will always have the ambition to go out and meet adversity and rebuild. So We congratulate the people of Houston for the great job they're doing. And once again, let's congratulate all the workers, all the volunteers, everybody who's doing all the heavy lifting as we speak down in Houston. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Thank you.